At Midnight GMT, welcome to the newsroom from...
Edgar Tamayo is a Mexican citizen. He is also a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where executioners are preparing to put Edgar Tamayo to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Lori Lubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and featured guest Tony Payan, director of the Mexico Center at the Baker Institute at Rice University. The execution watch for Edgar Tamayo begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch, and tonight we have the sad occasion to deal with the case of Edgar Tamayo. Standing by in Huntsville is Gloria Rubeck, our reporter. Gloria.
The death penalty should be abolished. It's a system that does not work.
She's on the megaphone.
Yeah, Gloria is on the megaphone.
It's anti-poor. 90% of the people on death row couldn't even hire an attorney. So if you don't have money, Texas can kill you.
Gloria, this is Ray.
It doesn't matter if you're innocent or guilty.
She's still on the megaphone.
If you don't have money, Texas will kill you.
Gloria. Gloria. Hello, Ray Hill. I'm in your pocket.
Oh, shit. Hello,
Gloria, you're on the air. What's going on there? We lose her?
Yeah, I don't know.
And so, call her back. Okay, so as that is being made, Gloria is outside the death chamber in Huntsville. Primarily, she's there to observe the coming and going there, and her report is up front, because she is to inform us whether or not the procedure has begun. That is usually signaled by her report that the witnesses have crossed the road. And if that is the case, then the procedure has begun. She was on the megaphone, so I suppose she was talking to those witnesses as they... You're on the air, Gloria. Gloria, what's happening in Huntsville?
Well, there's a huge crowd out here. There's about five live-eye trucks. News media from Fox 26 in Houston to Al Jazeera to media from Mexico is out here. There's a crowd of about 25 or 30 family members and friends of Edgar out here. His immediate family is not out here. They're at the hospitality house. Nobody is going to witness the execution, so we're waiting for the media. Walk across the street, but that has not happened yet. They've turned the lights on in that little house that used to be where they sold crafts, prisoner crafts. And so they're preparing for a press conference afterwards. And then they've got a stage set up, which I don't think I even remember this for Carla Faye Tucker or Shaka, which are two of the biggest.
No, this deals
a stage set up with all the media on it.
This deals with the killing of a police officer.
I guess the cops are down at the other end of the street. I saw a group of them walking to the Subway sandwich shop about 30, 40 minutes ago. But, they're cops are here somewhere.
Okay, so, but as of right now, no witnesses have crossed. John Grazik has not walked across
the road. No, I haven't seen Mr. Grazik.
Okay.
And he's kind of hard to miss.
Yeah.
So we're waiting. It's a couple of minutes, 3 minutes after. So I don't know. I mean, people are poised with their cameras, so they're waiting for something to happen. I understand, which is unusual, that the police officer's family or witnesses, the victim's witnesses went in around 5 o'clock, and usually we don't we don't see them. So I don't know what was up with that. So anyway, we're waiting here with a huge crowd. We're kind of taking over.
There seems to be kind of a balance between, there's always a demonstration of police officers when the victim or alleged victim in the case is a police officer.
Right.
We later on in the program are going to have Professor Tony Payan, who is a PhD from Rice University, who is an authority on Mexican-American relationships. And so we're going to have him on to talk about the sensitive issue of all of that. Mr. Tamayo's family is all at the hospitality house?
I don't see his parents or his daughters, who are the people that I can recognize. I've got a nephew standing right by me. Would you want to say anything to a very friendly radio station? No? Okay.
You had someone from the family with you in the Martin Luther King parade.
Oh, yeah, we had about 30 people.
Yeah. And someone from the family was there.
Right. But I don't know who is out here that can speak English, and they're praying. They're saying the rosary.
Okay. But you understand from, I understand from information that you have that no one in the family had agreed to witness the execution.
Well, no. Edgar did not want anybody to witness.
Okay.
I was with his two daughters yesterday, and I asked them, who's going to witness? And they said, my dad doesn't want anybody there.
Okay. The situation is not, we're not broadcast. We're on HD channel.
Right, yeah.
And so there's no way to call in, but you have Elizabeth's cell phone number. Would you report to her if something happens?
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much, Gloria.
Okay.
And that was Gloria Ruback, who is an activist with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And you can find out more about her and her organization at www.abolitionmovement.org. And I do know that they meet on certain Tuesdays of the month at the Shape Center, so you can follow those activities with her. I think we're now trying to get Dave Atwood on the line. And if we can get Dave on the line, Dave is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And Dave also marched in the Martin Luther King Parade with the In Mass Incarceration Coalition. And he is with the, his website for his organization is www.tcadp.org. And Dave is at a site here in Houston where there is a vigil taking place in opposition to execution. And so here is, I think we got Dave ready to come on. Okay, Dave, you're on the air. Hello, Dave. Dave, can you hear me?
Hello.
You're on the air. Dave, you're on the air.
Okay, I'm here.
Okay, right. Where is here?
Here is out in front of St. Anne's Catholic Church at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd.
With the construction and a lot of traffic.
Oh, man, it's just wild out here. This is traffic central, I think. A lot of people here. A lot of cars.
Well, what kind of crowd you got?
We've got about 14 or 15 people here today.
All right. There's a good crowd in Huntsville.
Yeah, I would expect there would be. I know just because of the nature of the case, you would expect to have a lot of people up there.
Well, you've got supporters on one end of the block, and we got police officers on the other end of the block.
Right.
They set up better accommodation for the police officers than they have for the regular demonstrators, but that's to be expected, too. This is a new beginning for a new year. After a long sabbatical, we're going back into the killing business. You have any comment?
Well, each execution is a sad event. As I said before, it's totally unnecessary. We don't have to be doing this. At the same time, I know executions are going down in Texas, and so are death sentences. So I do think that we're heading in the right direction. I just wish it would happen faster. And I can always tell when we're out here on the corner by comments of people that compared to, say, 10 or 15 years ago, where most people seem to be for the death penalty. Now most of the comments you get are against it. So I think we are heading in the right direction. It's just not happening soon enough for any of us. And obviously for the guys on death row, it's not happening soon enough. I think we've got, I don't know, 7 or 8 more executions already scheduled. We'll just keep fighting it, Ray. You know, there's more and more people involved in the fight against the death penalty across the state, certainly in Houston. And every time there's an execution, there are more and more people that get concerned and interested. Obviously today, the citizens of Mexico and the people from Mexico that live here in Houston, there was a protest this morning out by the Mexican consulate that was called by Alianza Mexicana. And so new people coming to that protest that took place. And, you know, I think that the death penalty is going to go away. I just wish it would go a little bit faster.
Well, Dave, I was with you for a short while on the Martin Luther King March, where the contingent opposed to execution well received by the attending audience.
Right, right. That was really great. They got, you know, a lot of different issues were right out there in our group, not only the anti-death penalty, but the end mass incarceration, which you're so active in. And I think, you know, there's people are waking up and understanding that this problem that we have with our criminal justice system, both executions and mass incarceration, is not what we should be doing as a civilized society. And we have to change things. And
David, when is the next meeting or activity for WWWT?
Okay, right. We're having the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, which is TCADP.org, is having our annual conference up in Fort Worth on February 22nd. And there will be carpools going up there. So if anybody that's listening is interested, they could either go to that website, which is tcadp.org, or they could give me a call somehow, get a hold of me, and we can, I think, arrange for people to go up there.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ray.
Bye-bye. And that's David Wood with Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty. And now we're back in the studio, and Jim, tell me what you can about this case.
It's pretty well short and sweet. What happened back in the first part of January in 1994, a man was robbed outside of a nightclub in southwest Houston. He flagged down a young officer, 24-year-old young man by the name of Guy Gaddis. He told him he'd been robbed and gave a description of his assailant, Mr. Gaddis. The officer Gaddis then picked up Edward Tamayo. I patted him down, and what they normally do is handcuff him with his hands behind his back and put him in the back of a patrol car. Somehow, when he got in the back of a patrol car, Edgar Gaddis was able to pull a revolver that the officer had missed in a pat-down and pulled the revolver out and shot the officer 3 times in the back of the head. The car then careened off the road, crashed into a house. And then at that point, Mr. Gaddis kicked out the back window and escaped, still in handcuffs. He was caught shortly, just not too far from the scene, still wearing the handcuffs with the murder weapon. His explanation at the time to the police was that he was all mad at Officer Gaddis because when he got arrested, he wanted Officer Gaddis to permit him, Tamayo, to give his keys to his wife so the wife could take the car home. The officer wouldn't do it. He said that's why he shot and killed the officer, and that's pretty much it.
So there's no question of guilt or innocence?
None whatsoever.
Right. And so he was placed in custody, and he's been in custody ever since, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Have you got the description of the case sorted out?
Yes.
Okay.
Larry's going to discuss. Well, the major issue on this case, as you well know from reading newspapers, is the thing they call the Avena decision that came out of the International Court of Justice. And to understand that, we're going to have to go into some kind of technical stuff about whether or not it would apply to Texas and the use of our exclusionary rule and some of the opinions that followed the Avena decision in state court as well as in the federal court. And I've asked Larry to discuss what the exclusionary rule, how it applies to this case.
Okay, we're going to sort it out right here in the studio. You're listening to Execution Watch. I'm Ray Hill, and we're in a very small studio, and we have to play musical chairs every once in a while. But here is that man with the Real Pipes. It's Larry Douglas. Hey, Larry.
Hello, Ray. Well, the Texas statutory exclusionary rule, the exclusionary rule, is intended to keep evidence obtained from tainted sources from coming in evidence in court. And it's more of an equitable rule to keep. When you go into court, you need to have clean hands, and that also applies to law enforcement. So the rule of, states, in essence, that just reading from the rule itself, says no evidence obtained by an officer or other person in violation of any provision of the Constitution or laws of the state of Texas or the Constitution or laws of the United States of America shall be admitted in evidence against the accused on the trial in any case. So if the evidence is obtained in violation of the Texas Constitution, Texas laws, or the United States Constitution, or United States laws, cannot be introduced in evidence. So it has to be a law that's violated in order to prevent the introduction of evidence that's obtained through through some sort of a tainted process.
Larry, is that a real clear line, or is that sounds pretty foggy to me?
Well, the law itself is fairly clear, but it has to be applied, and there's certain restrictions. That is, there's got to be a causal connection between the evidence that's sought to be excluded and the law violation. For instance, if in order to take it, and in this case, we're typically what we're talking about are confessions, and sometimes confessions, while they might be used, might not necessarily be necessary to gain a conviction. And in the Tamayo case, I'm just not even sure that that was even necessary. But for instance, if you're trying to use a confession in a juvenile case. Well, a juvenile has to be either taken. The parents have to be notified.
Yeah.
And so, if the parents are not notified, then you would think that the confession can't be used. Well, there's got to be causal connection. That is, you've got to inquire further as to whether, if the parents had been notified, that would have made a difference. The parents have to come forward and say, "Had I been notified, then he would not have given a statement." Or also there's another statutory requirement that a juvenile has to be taken before a magistrate. And the magistrate, in the absence of law enforcement, has to then question the juvenile. But if, again, if that would not have made a difference, that is, if the juvenile would have given the statement anyway, then the statement still comes in.
Or if the statement was irrelevant.
Irrelevant or not even necessary. Okay. That's the whole purpose of getting a confession, is to be used to support the conviction. But oftentimes, as in this case, I don't even think any statement that Tamayo might have made with the overwhelming evidence against him would not have made a difference whatsoever.
I mean, he had handcuffs on. Handcuffs,
he still had the weapon on him,
yeah.
Caught right after the incident. So the evidence again was overwhelming, and typically the way the exclusionary rule works is that defenders are pretty familiar with filing a motion to suppress the evidence,
yeah,
to keep the evidence out. But even if the evidence is not suppressed, if during the trial, if the facts show that there is a possibility of tainted evidence, then the defendant, the accused, is also entitled to a jury instruction saying the jury can ignore the evidence, is required not to. If the jury finds that the evidence was illegally obtained,
yeah,
then the jury has to then not pay attention to the evidence. In any case where the legal evidence raises an issue hereunder, the jury shall be instructed that if it believes or has a reasonable doubt that the evidence was obtained in violation of the provision of this article, then in such event, the jury shall disregard any such evidence so obtained. So it's the exclusionary rule is pretty much as it states. It's intended to exclude certain evidence from coming in so long as the evidence has been obtained through some sort of a tainted process. And there's also got to be shown that the evidence would not have been obtained but for the violation.
Can you tell from the record if any of this discussion came up during the trial?
I don't think that it was, because the evidence that they're seeking to to use in this case is the failure to advise Tamayo of his right to a consular contact. There's, first of all, that right to a consular contact is from a treaty,
yeah,
which is not even doesn't even apply. The law doesn't apply to treaties because treaties are not laws of the state of Texas or the Constitution of Texas, not laws under the United States Constitution or the laws of the United States
now,
government.
The standard that you stated earlier comes from federal court decisions.
The standard, the exclusionary rule.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the Texas,
it's a Texas
statutory
okay.
exclusionary rule, but it does apply because even in Texas law, we do not allow violations of the United States Constitution or United States laws.
It stated that, yeah.
It's stated specifically in the law, but the treaties are not laws, and that would have to be shown in order to even for this to even apply.
Okay.
But we're just going through it just to establish
how
foundation.
Often, how often does this actually come up? How often do we have this discussion about possible treaty violations? I know we've had it several times around this table.
Okay, we're having it now. Okay,
this is not the first time we've had it.
But it's brought up primarily in death penalty type cases,
okay.
And some people would argue that it's groping at the last straw, that it really does not apply, especially when you consider the fact that it's not a law. It's a treaty between nations, not to be applied to individuals who are accused of crimes. It just does not apply.
In Texas's eyes?
It's not a law. So
well, I hear
lawyers, and that's really what we're going to be discussing. Okay. I'm just laying out the basis
okay.
of the exclusionary rule.
Okay, and I'm not here to argue with my lawyers because God only knows that depend on.
Kind of okay. Thanks, Ray. Yeah. What it basically says that assuming there was a treaty violation in this case,
okay.
the way courts would handle it, but excluding the evidence that came from any type of illegal activity, they yeah. said only applies to a federal law or to a state law, does not apply to treaties, and therefore they say a treaty violation, you cannot use that to exclude evidence in a subsequent trial. That's what it amounts to.
And that standard is a national standard?
Well, it started out in 1929. Supreme Court made it by statute.
Okay.
And what they did in that case, there was a case they held some guys incommunicado and they got confessions from. They said, you can't use a confession because you held them incommunicado for 4 days. You can't use those confessions.
Yeah.
Texas, but that was a Knapp case from back in the 20s. That's when it started. And so what happened, Texas passed a statute, 3823, that simply says anytime they gain evidence in violation of a law, but that law's got to be a federal law or a state law. It does not apply to treaties. And that's what the appellate courts have been consistently saying, that the treaty violation does not kick in the exclusionary rule.
Jim, we've discussed this before.
Oh, yeah. The Medellin case went up with it.
Yeah.
And that's where all this came back with Medellin, because in the Medellin case, the Supreme Court said that it's not applicable. States don't have to follow the Avena decision. We're going to discuss that further.
So I trust that this issue was raised on the appellate level several times.
No. What happened, by the time it was raised, it's done in subsequent writs, and they said they were barred by what was raised on the appellate issue, yeah, but they kicked it down. But they try to raise some more things on the pellet issue, and they simply, we have that statute, as you well know, you can only file one writ. And if you file a subsequent writ, they're not going to consider them.
From the record, can you decipher whether Mr. Tamayo was adequately represented in his trial?
Well, not much you can do in a case like that. You could have Evelyn Bailey and everybody in the world. How are you going to explain the facts? So
right.
There's not much to misrepresent.
Yeah. So,
and even the best they could have done, if the Mexican consulate had been contacted, was to provide him information to try to mitigate punishment and knew how that would work in Houston.
Just tell him to shut up.
Yeah, but you got a cop shot in the head 3 times. You're going to have, there's no mitigating that's going to stop that.
That's right. Absolutely.
I didn't mean to interrupt,
okay,
but
who's
I just
next?
To clarify that. Michael's going to explain.
Okay, coming to the, sir, is Michael Gillespie, and Michael is another practicing. All of our lawyers are practicing trial lawyers, except Jim, and he's kind of a coach for the team. Hey, Michael, you're on.
Good morning. After this case went through the trial situation,
yeah.
The countries of the world who were involved with the treaty got together and filed papers in the international court over the treaty. That's the international court. they came back and they made a recommendation, and that recommendation is that America should look at all of these cases that counsel has not been called and see if justice has been done. It's an opinion that has never been followed. It's an opinion that the President of the United States wrote a memorandum on, mm-hmm. suggesting that the American courts follow it.
Mm-hmm. George Bush sent a letter to Texas.
Correct.
On the similar situation on an earlier case.
But we have to look at the big picture. This treaty is made by America to protect Americans in different countries, mm-hmm. to protect our citizens. The fact that we have to protect their citizens is what a treaty is about.
Yeah.
But as Larry and Jim just explained, the courts pay no attention to that treaty. It's a treaty between nations. They're not part of this suit. And so the end result is, even though the international court said that we should follow this proper procedure, that the President of the United States said that we should follow this procedure, it hasn't mean anything. Because the procedure that should be followed does not substantially interfere with the rights of this case. As Jim said and as Larry said, the fact that he wasn't given the right to give a counsel had no difference to this case. What surprises me is that they're saying that nobody ever has made any difference. I can't believe that's true. It seems to me that a person from another country who does not understand our Constitution, who does not understand the right to remain silent, the right not to have to talk against yourself, they don't know that. You think when they come to America, they should be advised by their counsel that you don't have to talk to the authorities.
You mean we don't have an orientation program at the borders?
That's exactly true. Maybe we would have that. We wouldn't have this problem. But it seems to me to be a reasonable thing to do. But the unique thing to me becomes is, what is somebody from Mexico supposed to say when they're stopped by the police? I'm an illegal alien? Call my counsel? I think it's put people in a dilemma. You don't want to announce you're not an American, but yet you're supposed to announce that you're American. The amount of people we have from Mexico arrested in this city is staggering. I can't imagine how the Mexican council can do anything to help
okay,
these people.
Okay, let's flip this over. Suppose this happened in Barbados to an American citizen. Would they have a right?
They have the right to call the council. And again, if the council does not, if they're not given that right, what is the harm?
Would we be angry at Barbados if they didn't make them do that?
I would imagine we would be. And if you look at what just happened in North Korea with that retired serviceman who they grabbed for no reason and held, the embassy came in and got him out. This is critical to our citizens traveling other
sure.
lands. The fear for this is some country is going to punish us. Look what happened with the Indian consulate last week. We arrested an Indian consulate over wage and hour violations. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, they arrested numerous American embassy people. What the governments don't want to get involved in is a tit-for-tat with our citizens. But as Perry said, we don't care. This is Texas. This is Texas law. The big picture that the court and the international court said, has any harm become of this? And I have not seen anything that says there's been any harm in this case or any case. And when we have a case where a man...
Well, I suppose Mr. Tamayo might have a different opinion on whether or not harm's being done. He's fixing to get killed.
He's not a lawyer. He doesn't understand the system, the whole purpose of this.
But he does understand I'm dying.
Did anything make a difference? If he would have been given his counsel, would anything have made a difference? In this case, it would have not. Can I see a case in which a man does not understand our rules and says too much without advice? It doesn't do any good to be told you've got the right to have a lawyer when you don't understand what that means.
Yeah.
And somebody from your country and your culture should explain to you what a lawyer means. And again, confession is the one area where this really comes into play.
Mike, I want to go to the professor here. Tony Payan, tell us who you are and what it is you're doing over at the Baker Institute and Rice University.
At the Baker Institute, yeah. I'm currently the director of the Mexico Center at the Baker Institute at Rice University.
You understand the trouble I'm having here?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Now I have a two possible answer question. Are we treating people from Mexico the way we treat people from Mexico because they are the red-headed stepchild of the Western Hemisphere and we can get away with it? Or is Texas and, to a large degree, America, the Chris Christie bullies of international politics? And we can get away with whatever we do, but we expect a higher standard from others.
Well, it is true. I think that whenever the United States sees an American citizen in trouble, no matter where, And we've seen that in the case of Iran and Korea and other places. We definitely want their rights respected. And we want those countries to treat them with dignity and to get them to the United States, if at all possible, even when they're guilty of a crime. The United States seeks that actively, and there are millions of Americans who live in other countries. And by the way, in Mexico, there are 1.2 million Americans living, residing in Mexico. And so the United States has to be very careful that it protects the right of Americans living in Mexico. Now, the problem here is not the United States. The federal government, in fact, the State Department has been very clear.
Actually, the Secretary of State has asked Texas to be careful.
Correct. And they've actually done it with Oklahoma and other states in similar cases, Medellin, Avin, and others. And I think that in that sense, I think the U.S. government is on the Mexican side. It is the Texas government that is not. And we saw it in Oklahoma with Governor Keating and other governors, that they see this as the particular treaty, the Geneva Consular Relations Treaty, as non-self-executing, meaning it's a very technical issue, because they say, look, it's not that Texas is denying that there are responsibilities under the Geneva Treaty on Consular Relations.
Yeah.
It's obviously a U.S. treaty, and it is law. However, they say, well, there are two types of treaties, executing, self-executing treaties, which means no further legislation is necessary. Yeah. The treaty is explicit, it's law, it's accepted, it's there, it's self-executing. In the case of this particular...
Like trade laws.
Yes, in the case of this particular treaty, Texas and other states have argued that it's non-self-executing, meaning the U.S. made a commitment, but the U.S. needs to take the responsibility, and in this case it means the U.S. Congress, to pass further law, to execute the treaty, to specify the treaty into law. And that's where I think we've hit a snag, and most states like Texas can get away with it because they can say it's non-self-executing.
Have you looked into these things before? This is not the first time this has rolled across your stage.
Not at all. I think this is a long-standing dispute between Mexico and the United States. This has been around for a long time. Mexicans have always had a presence in the United States for a very long time.
And well, actually, where we lived used to be part of Mexico.
Well, correct. All the Southwest. And so millions of Mexican citizens today reside in the United States. And to Mexico, this is very important. And like they said correctly, the liability, the guilt of Tamayo is not in question. What the Mexican government has not done, however, is explicitly stated what their real intention is, which to me seems to be a commuting of the sentence. The Mexican government, like many countries in the world, do not agree with the death penalty.
Yeah.
They say, look, keep the guy in jail forever and
we
ever.
Don't care.
It's all right. I mean, we're not arguing that he's innocent.
This is the only issue that arises whenever we do something to a greater level of extremity than anyone else in the world.
It comes up every time the death penalty comes up.
I appreciate you coming by the Prison Show and joining us. You see, that is what I'm trying to get across to the audience is that when lawyers look at things, they're trying to look at things as lawyers. When academics look at things, they're trying to look at things as academics. When dumb shits like me look at things, we look at things like dumb stuff. And so it's very confusing to me, because I can imagine being an ex-criminal. I can imagine myself being somewhere and violating the law and not being able to have my counsel tell me, well, you better talk, because these people don't have the Fifth Amendment rule around here. And so let's see if we can, but I need some advice on that.
Yeah.
But Mr. Tamayo was busted, and he opened his mouth and gave his explanation of why he did what he did, and there were those handcuffs and the powder burns that obviously associated him closely to the case.
I don't even think the Mexican government is questioning the fact that he confessed. They're simply against the death penalty. I think that is really what it boils down to. They do not agree that with the death penalty, and they will oppose any case where the death penalty is involved.
I think our producer has an announcement.
I just wanted to give an update. I spoke about 5 minutes ago with Gloria, a reporter in Huntsville. She said the witnesses have not yet crossed the street. And by the way, I got a message from the Supreme Court people, the U.S. Supreme Court people, about 10 minutes to 6, saying that Tamayo's lawyers had filed a second petition asking for a stay. Okay. So apparently that's under consideration.
Yeah, well, let me explain to the audience what is happening in that regard, because we've been here before, too. The witnesses have not crossed the road, which means that the procedure has not begun. And the procedure, meaning the execution of Edgar Tamayo, has not begun. They don't begin until the witnesses take their places inside the execution chamber. Now, what happens when we do a last-minute or an in-progress appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States is it goes to Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, if he is in town and is working tonight and he doesn't have a dinner date over at the Federalist Society or some other good place like that, then he will answer the phone. Usually that is a quick response. If for some reason or other Justice Kennedy is not there, it could be Ruth Bader Ginsburg that answers the telephone. She, strangely enough, is a very good friend of Antonin Scalia, and she answers the phone when he is not available to do that. He can designate whoever answers the phone from the Fifth Circuit Court.
Scalia has already responded, right? You don't have to worry about
it. Well, nobody's already, but there's another appeal that just...
No, I'm talking about this appeal. Is he's already responded.
Oh, he did?
Yes.
What did he say?
I haven't read it yet. I got the note. He'd responded, so...
So Scalia's got it, and Scalia's responded.
Right.
So he has basically two options. He can go ahead and make a decision on his own.
They want to stay. It's going to be stay or no stay.
And he can, or he can refer to the court. If he refers to the court, right, it's a stay. And so thank you, Jim, for keeping track of it. See, cell phones keep people in touch with everything. But if it went to Scalia, it was his decision. And sometimes I have seen him refer it to the court.
I want to clarify a couple of things. The decision that came out of the International Court of Justice is called Avena. What Avena said is they recommended the states review these cases to see if they were harmed. By harm, what that means is, would the result have been different had Tamayo called his consulate? Doesn't mean hurt his feelings.
Yeah.
That's what it means. And also, I want to clarify another thing. It's not just Texas acting arbitrary. The Supreme Court, in two different decisions that Jack's going to discuss, said the states don't have to enforce the Avena decision. And the reason they said there's a separation of powers, because remember, the State Department is a part of the executive branch.
Sure.
They have no business, they say, bossing the Supreme Court around. It's a judicial branch. And Jack's going to discuss those decisions.
Okay, well, let's get Jack.
Because it's not just Texas, the Supreme Court is.
So this is an ongoing thing?
Yes.
I
wanted to clarify that.
I appreciate that, Jim. See, we anguish over these cases pretty seriously, and... the thing that I want to do as the host of the program is I want to give Mr. Tamayo's position as fair, reasonable a hearing as possible in the case. Jack, what you got?
Well, this goes back to the cases that I wanted to talk about is Sanchez-Llamas. And what happened in those two, the Supreme Court had two cases, and they simply decided to merge the two, and make a long story short, they came back and said, well, you know, we're not really going to talk about the Article 36 of the Vienna Convention, but we're going to reaffirm what we said in Medellin, that if it's not self-executing, the exclusionary rule that the exclusionary rule can apply. And it was an odd rationale. In this case, the Supreme Court said that because the exclusionary rule was idiosyncratic to American jurisprudence, it couldn't possibly have been on the minds of the people negotiating the Vienna Convention, and therefore it doesn't really apply. And if you really want to apply it, you're going to have to have legislation that basically executes the laws of the convention. Frankly, I have no idea why on earth the Supreme Court took this case. Frankly, the Supreme Court has a choice. They can.
Take a case or not take a case.
Take a case or not take a case. And frankly, it's almost like they took this case to mention that, oh, by the way, the exclusionary rule is something that's specific to American jurisprudence. I can't think of a reason.
Did the Supreme Court look at this case? I mean, is there an opinion in this case from the Supreme Court?
They didn't. In Tamayo, as far as Tamayo is concerned, they simply applied the Sanchez-Llamas case to Tamayo.
Okay, Jim, why don't you get
right, what happened is the Supreme Court decided two issues identical to the Tamayo issue on the consular relations in the Medellin case and the one you have pronounced it, Jack?
Sanchez-Llamas.
The Sanchez-Llamas, and there's no reason to review it again. That's already been decided.
Yeah. It's,
and another thing they said in those two Supreme Court decisions is that it's a treaty between two nations and an individual party has no standing to contest a violation. So they also said that.
Okay. Okay. So it's a standing issue as well as a principled issue.
And frankly, I'm not real sure why. Well, I mean, it makes sense why the governments want to get involved. Effectively, the federal government can say, you know, hey, look, I'm a parent. I've got 52 unruly adult children. I can't really control them, but I'll talk to them. And so that way the federal government gets to tell the other foreign governments, well, we're doing the best we can. We tell the states that we really think you should do this. You should review.
And so that's why you get the monkey motion from the Secretary of State.
Correct.
Saying this, that, and the other that sounds contrary to the flow of what's going on.
Correct.
But that doesn't really have like a lot of diplomatic mumbo jumbo that doesn't have any real traction.
It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't actually do anything, but it sure does sound good because the government at least is trying to be cooperative with foreign governments, trying to be sensitive to to the desires of foreign governments and things like that. And that way, the federal government, at least diplomatically, can wash its hands and say, look, it's our states. We have this unruly adult
this
child. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Jack. That was Jack Lee. And
I want to clarify one thing. As we speak now, Italy's trying an American citizen for murder as we currently speak, and there's been a whole bunch of trials.
Does Italy have executions?
I don't think so.
No.
And they've had a number of trials in different countries, American citizens, especially in drug cases.
Yeah.
We've had a bunch of those. So we're not the only ones prosecuting.
Well, drug cases can get you dead in some of those Eastern countries, yeah.
And Susan will be next.
Okay, Susan? Susan's working over there. The attorneys you have heard from are Jim Skelton up front, followed by Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie. That was Jack Lee, and now it's Susan Ashley's turn. Okay.
Talk to him.
Okay. There you go.
Talk to him. Mother-in-law. Promise
you. Okay. Go ahead, Susan.
Okay. Well, the big picture really is this. Let's just kind of go so everyone really understands this. The Vienna Convention on Consular Relations gave a foreign national who's arrested the right to contact his consular. Okay. And law enforcement officials that arrest him or incarcerate him or imprison him are required to inform him of that right. That is a treaty between nations. It is not a law. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has, on more than one occasion, in quite a few cases, in Rochas and Medellin, basically stated that it does not confer an individual right upon an individual defendant. It is because it's not a law, it's a treaty, that nations have the right to object. Okay, they can go to the Court of International Justice and object. That is also consistent with the way the Supreme Court has interpreted it, that it's a treaty between nations, it does not confer an individual right, and even a president's memorandum still does not confer a right on an individual, because a presidential memorandum is the president is the executive branch, and the courts have the sole right to interpret. Federal court, U.S. Supreme Court has the absolute right to interpret law.
Susan, would this even be an issue if we weren't executing somebody?
I think it's obviously the only reason we're talking about it is because it involves an execution, but we always have to look at it that countries enter treaties for their own benefit. The U.S. enters a treaty.
If we weren't on a countdown to the needle tonight, mm-hmm. if we're talking about somebody being locked up, somebody say, well, this is an appellate matter. We could handle this in different ways. But since it is so immediate and it is literally on the brink of actually happening and so final, that all of a sudden we go through all this monkey motion. This is a cost of a practice of executions. Is that fair?
It's a claim raised by the person who's going to be executed, you know, obviously to stay their execution.
Who is grabbing at straws in the best
of
circumstances.
I mean, that's basically it. Now, I mean, there may be many circumstances where Americans can be arrested in foreign countries. I don't think the violation, I think they may face the same thing in the court of other nations. But the U.S. may, in other words, the U.S. would have the right to object to the violation of the treaty and would put the whole thing in a diplomatic range outside of court of law. And I think it's a diplomatic problem, so to speak.
Okay. Professor raised his hand. You want to come in, Professor?
Yeah.
Professor, do you agree with me that if we weren't actually killing people, that we would just say, all right, life goes on, we'll have another appeal?
That's correct. I think in some sense, it is about the death penalty, and I think we have to be kind of honest about that. This has a lot of layers. Obviously, it has to do with separation of powers. The executive branch can issue a particular statement, and I think I agree that they're kind of covering their tracks. They want to make sure that the U.S.-Mexico relationship, which is already going through a rough patch, is not further affected by this. The new Peña administration in Mexico kicked the Americans out after unprecedented axes under the Calderon administration. So the American government is still trying to figure out how they're going to work with the Mexican government in the future. And this, and by the way, they're canceling all kinds of visits and all kinds of collaborative agreements with the United States. So there is kind of a retaliatory aspect about this. And the other issue is also not only about the separation of powers, it's also about federalism. I mean, the states do have their own interpretation of this. There's a couple of things I do not agree with that have been said, and obviously this is a matter of interpretation. I think one interpretation prevails today and a different one tomorrow. I think that treaties are law. They are law. And when a country enters into a treaty, it is effectively legislating, and this has been ruled upon many, many times. We can go back as far back as we can, and individual citizens of a country are very often, especially in self-executing treaties, obliged to abide by that treaty as if it were law. All treaties are law. Now, this is a school of thought. There's a different school of thought that says no treaties are self-executing. Congress has to act. Well, this is a kind of a philosophical disagreement. And the other issue is treaties are about individuals. No company, no individual can simply say when it is a self-executing treaty at a minimum, or when it is a non-self-executing treaty followed by congressional legislation, individuals are still bound. And the consular relations are about that. It's about protecting
At least Mexico is treating this as if this is a breach of law.
It is certainly, because they have a different reading of the law. I see international law as law.
Am I completely off base whenever I say that, generally speaking, the United States looks toward Mexico like it was a redheaded stepchild? I mean, is there something in our history, the Mexican-American War, the Alamo, that all of this bravado, that we diminish in our own minds the seriousness of issues that are raised south of the Rio Bravo?
Well, it is a complicated relationship. It's always been like that. The United States has never really dealt with Mexico on an equal basis as a kind of a true partner. But forget the United States. I think in the end, the federal government kind of understands the relationship. Let's talk about something else, Texas. I think it would have been kind of gracious and perhaps even sensitive of Governor Perry to sort of stay that execution and allow a hearing and allow the process to work itself out. That's all Mexico is asking. to kind of exhibit the process for what it is.
Show us some good faith.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Governor Perry has very little to lose today. I mean, he's not running for office again. So he could have just done
Hopefully
that.
Hopefully not president again. Well, we can't stand the embarrassment.
Yes, let's let him run.
The only problem is that that I see, or the only reason why he wouldn't do it, in addition to the fact that he's just insensitive to the Texas-Mexico relationship. I'm not going to talk about the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Yeah. The importance of Texas to Mexico and the importance of Mexico to Texas. Governor Perry could have just spent a little bit of political capital, probably not very much, because he's not vulnerable electorally right now, to just simply say, fine, we'll give this guy a hearing. That's what the Mexican government says. Let the case work itself through the courts. The only reason I think that Governor Perry refuses to do that is because he may do a run in 2016, and he's not really talking to Mexico. He's not really talking to moderates. He's probably talking to the Tea Party. And to go into an internal race in the Republican Party with having to be accountable for doing this would have been a disaster. I mean, I think he's not going to make it. But
Dr. Tony Payan, Rice University. Is that correct pronunciation?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much for doing that. My name is Ray Hill, and this is still Execution Watch. I'll ask Elizabeth if we had any word about chickens crossing the road.
No, actually, there's been no word from the Supreme Court about whether the second petition has been ruled on. So as far as we know, Tamayo's second petition is still being considered
well,
by
we'll
the Supreme Court.
We'll take a poll by the end of the show and get a general feeling of the room whether Mr. Tamayo lasts until morning or not. So y'all get ready for a Q&A. Susan, welcome back.
Okay. The U.S. Congress could adopt that provision of the Vienna Convention as part of federal law. All the Congress would have to do is pass a law saying we adopt it and it's part of our federal law.
But okay. They have not done that.
They have not done
that. Or much else recently, anyway.
And the Supreme Court, in their decisions on the matter, they have also pointed this out, that it has not been adopted and incorporated into federal law by virtue of a Congress passing it. At the same time, the Texas legislature could do the same thing. I mean, they could basically say, we're going to adopt. We have obviously a lot of Mexicans get arrested in Texas, and the Texas legislature could say, we're going to adopt that portion of the Vienna Convention and incorporate it into Texas law and Texas criminal procedure. And of course, that hasn't happened. And so that's where you end up with that the individual does not have standing to object to a violation of the convention. Only countries do. And so that's really where you end up on it.
Well, let me tell you what's happening to Mr. Tamayo. Mr. Tamayo is, in fact, not laying there with needles in his arm. He is sitting in a cell next to execution chamber. They will not take him into that room and strap him down and put needles in his arm until the business with the courts is complete. So Mr. Tamayo is not laying there in discomfort and in anticipation of not knowing what those things in his veins are doing to him. I was corrected on that some time ago by getting a call from one of the executioners who told me exactly what happens. Until the courts give the final word, there is no needles. And so Mr. Tamayo is sitting in a cell next to the execution chamber in the walls in Huntsville. He has witnesses from the victims, and he has witnesses from the media that will be escorted over when he is put in place and the needles are in place. No one will be allowed to come witness that execution until he is hooked up to be killed. We have got less than 10 minutes in this show left. So now that you know going on in Mr. Tamayo's life, we have no idea what's happening in Washington, D.C., but we're going to poll the available people whether or not they think Mr. Tamayo will be alive in the morning, or is he going to get executed tonight?
I think he'll be executed.
Jim thinks clearly he'll be executed. Anyone disagree with Jim? Any of the lawyers? No, it's all pretty cut and dry. And the reason he's going to be executed is because you don't think there's any issue here having to do with possible innocence.
Here's the problem we've got. These are subsequent writs, and this writ's being filed as out of a commission I'm not familiar with, the subsequent writ. And the courts have been real cranky about granting subsequent writs after writs have already been filed. And one thing I want to clarify, when they talk about a violation of the law, there are a whole bunch of laws that don't kick in the exclusionary rule.
Yeah.
And all they're simply saying is that a treaty...
Well, actually, nothing is being excluded
right.
in this case.
And in the first place, let's assume that he got a hearing. The best they're going to be able to do is have a hearing, and they'd have to show that the result would have been different at this hearing had he been advised by his counsel.
And
how are you going to change that result?
Yeah.
You're not going to change that result because the most it would ever work for the violation would exclude his statement. That's it. And they don't need his statement because they got the handcuffs, they got the gun, they got the witness. And they also got the witness that identified him in the robbery. So I'm just telling you that in this particular case, even if a hearing was granted, it's going to be a waste of time because there's no way in the world they're going to be able to show harm. Now, what they're going to argue, and here's what they've been arguing, and those of us who tried cases know this. Their new claim is that he was retarded. And had he been given caught hold of the consulate, they could have developed a mental retardation issue. Let me tell you the danger of that. Every lawyer who's tried death penalty cases is really concerned when they claim somebody's mental retarded because what you're doing, you're telling the jury, this guy can't be fixed. He's retarded. He's dangerous. And that gives impetus to give the death penalty.
Yeah.
It doesn't mitigate as a general rule. It's that old argument.
Yeah, we've been through that before.
Yeah,
and it doesn't work. Just because there's the potential of something making a difference doesn't mean that that's actually going
right.
to make a difference in the mind of the jury and all that. I suspect Mr. Tamayo is not going to be with us in the morning, and I don't know the state of what's going on, but I do know that the family, wherever they are suffering. When we deal with these cases, as you can tell from tonight's show, we anguish quite sincerely over the minute details, both legal, social, cultural, anthropological. But I've got a quick and easy solution to our problem. Why don't we just stop killing people? And if we just stop killing people, it would be like that case of an American citizen over in Italy. Let's go ahead and have a trial, see what comes out of the trial, and then let's deal with how we can mitigate the punishment at a later date under a different forum, because there still is time to do something differently. But the fact that we're killing people, the fact that we're executing people, it's going to be all final. Our next execution scheduled is supposed to be Suzanne Basso. And Elizabeth, there's a lot going on in Suzanne's case, isn't there, President?
Yes, her lawyer has...
Come closer. You got to get to either this microphone or that one.
Yes, her lawyer has filed a motion, and it's still pending.
And she has some competency issues. She has some future dangerousness issues. You can check on what we find out in advance by going to our Facebook page. That is, get on Facebook, and in Facebook search, put Execution Watch, and we will pop right up. Also would encourage you to listen in on the goings-on on Facebook at the end of mass execution, where we're discussing all of these issues all the time. I want to thank Otis McClay for hands-on engineering tonight. Our producer, Elizabeth Stein, has done a wonderful job with it. Victoria Panetti provides the music. Our lawyers are Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, Jack Lee. Our guest was Tony Payana, reporters from Huntsville, Gloria Ruback, from Houston, Dave Atwood. I'm Ray Hill, the host, and we hope we do not have another show to do.